Bob and Colin, it's John Shannon for this Thursday. Well, for anybody who has not listened to the radio program that I did, John and I did for many, many years, you may be unfamiliar with this guy by name and based on the conversations we've had with him. But he's don't turn this one off. I think you'll enjoy this.
This is like Christmas.
He's the executive producer of Sunday Night Football on NBC. Longtime producer, director, executive producer of Monday Night Football as well. He's the guy. He is the guy in the truck right now. Fred Gadelli will join us after these messages. Bob McCown, it's John Shannon on the program for this Thursday. We welcome you aboard, and we are excited to have our next guest with us. He has been on he was on the radio program, which was a television program as well on many occasions. But I think Gadelli, this is the first, it's Fred Gadelli, the executive producer of Sunday Night Football on NBC. I think this is the first time we've actually done a Zoom call together, isn't it?
That would be correct.
Yeah. So it's nice to see your face and a face that the audience is not that familiar with, which leads me to wonder how people wind up as Shannon did too, as producers, executive producers.
Because we couldn't get hired as announcers.
Well, that I guess is partly the point. Did you aspire when you were a kid, Fred, to be on air?
1,000%. I mean, I grew up wanting to be Marv Albert. So I grew up in New York in the 60s and 70s. Marv was the Knicks, the Rangers. He did the local sports on the NBC affiliate.
Sure.
And he did football on NBC. And, you know, I was a diehard New York sports fan. And I mean, as soon as I figured out that I wasn't going to play center field for the Yankees or, you know, power forward for the Knicks or quarterback for the Giants, I was like, okay, I'm going to be Marv Albert. And that's what I set out to do. And I did it in college. But Bob, like, your voice is awesome. My voice isn't awesome. And I kind of realized that pretty quickly. I didn't sound like Al Michaels or Dick Enberg or any of those. And I got an internship working on a show in New York City. An old New York sportscaster by the name of Bill Mazur was called.
Remember him well.
Yeah. And it was like a recap of the week in sports in New York on Sunday nights, and I was in production, and I was like the only person in production. So I was like, you know what? This might be a better avenue for me, because my voice just doesn't sound like Bob McCann's.
I was at Channel 5?
Yeah, Channel 5.
There you go.
You know, that's interesting you bring that up, Gadelli, because there was a time when a big voice was almost a fundamental criterion for getting a job in broadcasting. That is absolutely no longer the case. I'm sort of fascinated by the evolution and the acceptance of people who don't have deep voices.
You know, I think that's true, but not as like the elite play callers of games or maybe the elite, you know, studio analysts. So a guy like Al Michaels, a Jim Nance, a Joe Buck, I mean, their voices really cut through. And when you turn on a game and you hear them, you kind of, okay, this is going to be good tonight. This is a big time, you know, this is a big time production. I think, you know, in the advent of talk radio, and especially in New York, yeah, having even speaking proper English isn't a requirement in New York, but having a big voice. When you're talking about those big events, you're used to hearing, you know, people who sound like professional announcers.
I think the bigger key, Bob, is not necessarily the big ballsy voice, but it's, is it easy to listen to? You know, does it become like, is it comfortable? I mean, you never want a voice to be on the other end of the speaker that says, wow, that's hard to listen to. And I think that's the biggest change more than anything else. It becomes listenability, if there's such a word.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Well, I'll tell you, one of the reasons I bring it up is like many people in North America, I have Sirius XM, and I started listening to 70s on 7, that channel.
Yeah.
And there and all the, well, because all the well, it's the funny thing. I mean, I sort of my era. But I tended to be more in the 80s and a little bit in the 90s and you know, Beatles channel, whatever else. And I went to 70s and all the jocks there have these big deep voices, you know. Sure. And I remember the days, you probably don't even know anything about this, but there was a radio station in the 70s in Windsor, Ontario, / Detroit, Michigan. Sure. It was the number one top 40 radio station.
The Big Eight.
North America, the Big Eight, CKLW. And every single guy that they put on the air would shake the dishes out of your cabinet. You know, they had these big ballsy voices. And, you know, it's still identifiable with that era.
No doubt.
And if you listen to guys today, you know, they have good voices, but not quite the same.
MTV changed that a little bit though.
Well, yeah, because if you go to the 80s, the voices, the three or four people that are on there were all the original VJs, right?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah,
that's right. Yeah. No. Hey, I'm
like, she's had some really serious work done on her throat. Nina Blackwood.
Nina Blackwood,
she's got gravel in that throat.
Oh, no kidding.
I'm curious, Fred. So you talked about idolizing certain announcers and certain guys, and what producer did you idolize? Because there is a strain of that in our business too. Is once you identify with someone, you become cloned of and said that you are reminded of that person. Not, you know, in our country, I worked for a guy named Ralph Mellenby for many years, and so I have always been called a protege of Ralph's. So where did it start for you from on a production side?
Well, I would say Rune Arledge, because I was growing up, ABC Sports had the Olympics, they had Monday Night Football, they had the big college football package, and my senior thesis was sports television in America, and so I had to do a lot of research. And there was something about watching games on ABC or watching sporting events on ABC to me that just felt different. And as I really learned about Rune Arledge, that's kind of who I, you know, set my sights on. And then I got to work for his two top proteges, Don Allmire and Dick Ebersol. I would say Rune Arledge, without a doubt, was the person that I think everybody in my position set their sights on.
Did you ever meet him?
I never met Rune.
No. So not to hijack the conversation. So I worked at the Olympics in Calgary in 1988. And I never met him, but it was almost as exciting. There was a sighting. Yeah. We went to the wrap party at the end of the games. CTV was the Canadian rights holder and ABC. They were partners. And across the room, there was a Rune sighting. And that to me was almost as exciting as meeting him. And that really, in the end, was one of his swan songs, in the sports side, at least, at the network.
Yeah, that was ABC's last Olympics. And there was always a lot of mystery surrounding rooms, kind of like the way he wanted it.
Yeah.
With Fred Godelli, the executive producer of Sunday Night Football. And to that point, the point being your executive producer now, you know, John knows, I probably should know, but I've never paid that much attention.
You think you're a producer, but that's okay.
Well, I generally ignore producers.
Yes.
Do what I want to do. And if they give me hell, go away. So what's the fundamental difference between a producer and an executive producer?
You know, I think in my particular case, I kind of run the relationship with the NFL. So as it amounts to, you know, trying to figure out what games we're going to get on the schedule, any other type of business dealings NBC's having, you know, with the National Football League, you know, I'm the kind of front and center person on that. Whereas if I was just a producer, you know, I'd be producing the games and getting people ready for that. So there's a managerial component to it. There's a business component to it. You know, I would say that would be the fundamental difference between a producer and executive producer.
But you still sit in the chair, no?
Absolutely.
The fundamental difference usually is the executive producer doesn't actually do the game. Fred's the chief bottle washer and the cook still.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I wasn't coming out of the truck. So
no, yeah, that's interesting because we had an incident in a hockey game last week where a terrible injury to the captain of the Toronto Maple Leafs, John Tavares, and I got phone calls from people. How do you manage, you know, issues like this? It was comparable to the Joe Theismann broken leg scenario years ago. And so I was talking to some reporters and you went through it. And then the reporter at the end said, how do you manage all that? I said, are you kidding me? That's the thrill of being in the business. Yeah. And I think I would expect that you still, when you sit down and the game starts, you still in many ways think you're a player or at least have that thought process as a player. Would that be fair?
I think you get the adrenaline rush you would get by playing the game. I don't know that I'm thinking like a player. I'm trying to think like, you know, somebody that's putting on a live event. But there's that adrenaline that really, you know, keeps pumping for the amount of time you're on the air and then takes a long time to subside when you get off the air. But yeah, definitely, you know, that's where I'd say playing, there would be the similarity.
Shannon, when he worked in the business, was noted as a complete and utter jerk and a yeller and a screamer.
Oh, God.
Now, I never worked with him, Freddie, but only in this capacity. So I can't attest to this, but I have many, many, many witnesses.
You do not.
I do indeed, to his insanity. How would you describe yourself? Are you calm, cool, collected, or do you lose your mind in the truck every now and again?
Well, I think I've gotten a lot better over the last 35 or 40 years. One thing I figured out pretty quickly was if you were going to belabor somebody else's mistake or even your own mistake, there was probably going to be a bunch of other mistakes coming down the road while you were venting your frustration or anger.
Yeah.
So I've tried to, I've gotten a lot better over the course of my career. There was a time I was definitely a yeller. There was no question about it. But, you know, it just... there's just diminishing returns all the way around. So I try to stay calm, cool, and collected these days, but I also try to hold people accountable. So, it's that kind of, you know, trying to thread that needle.
There is a little frustration that occurs.
I mean, you've worked really hard and you want perfection. You know, perfection's not possible, but you're trying to get as close to it as you can.
And you want people to listen.
What's that?
You want people to listen.
And you want people to listen. Yeah, listening's not a problem on my show. They all listen.
So just by quite by happenstance, I saw an interview you did, I think, a year ago with our friend Peter King.
Yeah.
On his podcast. And you guys were talking off the top about Sunday Night Football having been the number one show in television for 9 consecutive years. I should know the answer to this, but did you make it to 10?
We did.
Attaboy. What is that, you know, with a career, you've been 30 plus years doing what you do. What does that mean at this point?
Well, I mean, obviously it's a record that no other television show in the history of our country has ever approached. I think American Idol did it 6 straight years and that was a juggernaut. So there's a lot of pride that goes with that. But there's also the reality knowing that this is the National Football League. It's the number one, forget about sports entity. It's the number one entertainment entity in America. We happen to broadcast it on a night in our country where the most people that watch TV during the week are watching on Sunday night. And, you know, I think we have a good show. And we have, you know, great announcers. And the NFL, you know, gives us a pretty good schedule because they like having the number one show as much as NBC does. So, you know, there's a lot of pride with that. I mean, I kind of think about it. I don't know if I think about number one every day, but I think about Sunday Night Football every day. And that's probably, you know, that's just, you know you're working on something special.
How do you draw the line between keeping it fresh and respecting the traditions that you've built over that period of time?
Well, you know, it's funny because we were talking about Rune Ardalage, and I remember Don Allmeyer said something to me one time, and he said, you know, no matter how good something is that you just did, it can probably be better. And that really stayed with me, and I've tried to apply that really to every single aspect of our show, you know, from the smallest thing to the largest thing. And we spend a lot of time this time of the year with the entire team. We have a weekly meeting, And we try to, you know, we kind of evaluate all of our elements and all of our executions and say, hey, look, how could this be better? How could this look better? How could this be executed better, sound better? Is this the best way to accomplish what we're trying to accomplish here? So we kind of tear it down and build it up. Because I just don't, staying the same just doesn't interest me. I mean, it just, it's boring. And, you know, I've been doing the same sport now for over, 30 years. So you have to find ways to try to make it more entertaining for the viewer.
I'm curious. You said that you're in the off season. You still meet through the whole off season? Never take a break?
We take a break. February, March, we take a break. And then April 1st, we put the band back together and we meet once a week for 3 hours. And it's a brainstorm / tear down last year. And, what are the new ideas we're bringing this year?
Technical innovation is something I think observers like myself, like John, we understand them, but we tend to overlook them over time because there's always another one after another one after another one. As somebody who has to deal with all this, right, is there one that jumps out to you as the most significant technical innovation that you've experienced?
Well, I think in the history of sports television, there are a couple of really significant innovations. I would say number one would be instant replay, right? That changed the way, games could now be viewed and you could see a play as many times as the producer or director wanted to show it to you. I would say the first and 10 line changed football and brought, virtual imaging into, broadcasting that transcended, so from the first and 10 line, you got the, you got the pitch box where you see where the ball crosses the plate and all that. And I would say the constant clock and score, I don't think any of us could watch a sporting event again where the score and the clock wasn't up there the entire time. So I would say those three things to me, are probably the most significant.
Was there one of those that was the most difficult? And I know instant replay came along before your time.
Absolutely.
So it was well established, I guess, by the time.
Not before yours, though, Bob. So
not before mine. Nothing happened before me.
No, I know.
I'm humble about this, but I did invent dirt. But is there one that has caused you more difficulty, more anxiety, more the inability to understand it than anyone else? Any other?
The first and 10 line. What is real science? I mean, there were scientists who developed this and they were able to figure out a way, using GPS technology to train camera lenses and then extract data out of a camera lens. I mean, no one had ever done that. I don't know that anyone ever dreamed of that.
Yeah.
But they did. I got to biology. I don't think I made it to chemistry in high school. So that was well above my understanding. I understood the basics of, we're going to pull this data out of the lens and through this data, we're going to be able to insert a virtual line that's not going to move all over the field camera pans. But that was some, that was some real skilled scientists with some futuristic brains. Now, I'm guessing instant replay had to be similar because, people shot film. But then you had to go develop film and that took time. And now here was somebody coming up with an idea. Hey, I can record this and play it back instantly. I'm sure it was the same kind of, the same kind of thought in someone's mind that allowed that to happen.
The other interesting thing is your viewership, and I think most sports viewership, is now so sophisticated that they understand the job you do. Whereas I think when you started being a producer, I would expect that it was, we always kind of created that smoke and mirrors mentality, is that it's magic and we're going to show it to you. But now if there's something in one of your Sunday night games that there's a replay that you don't show, your viewership expects it and demands it.
Right. No, I mean, the viewers have definitely become more sophisticated and people are writing about and talking about broadcasts, good, bad, or indifferent. And no, I mean, there's no question everybody and, the whole social media aspect of it where, you're pretty much getting instant feedback on, what you did or didn't do. there's no question. It's a more sophisticated audience, and they're all too ready to let you know how you're doing.
How do you manage social media reaction?
You know, I just, I mean, you know, when people say, oh my God, Twitter is blowing up, what does that mean? Is it, you know, 15 people, 100 people, 60 people? I don't really know what that means. You know, look, you definitely look at it, but some of it, it's like anything else. It's an opinion, you know, and they're not sitting in the same seat that I'm sitting in. They're not watching the monitors I'm watching, or, you know, I mean, you know, certain things are just going to be polarizing by, you know, by their existence. Music, you know, not everyone likes the same music, you know, yeah, not everybody hates the same music. So there's always going to be things that are going to be, you know, polarizing, and you know that going in, so you don't get too worked up about it. But I try not to overreact to it, because you might be talking about, you know, 30 or 40 people when there's 20 million people watching this game.
32 years ago, you were doing Monday Night Football. I'm intrigued by how many cameras did you, do you remember how many cameras you had that first year you sat in the chair?
That was Sunday night on ESPN. And I'm going to say we might have had like 14 cameras.
And today?
Like 28.
So what's the fundamental difference of sitting in the truck and trying to manage that many more cameras?
Well, a lot of those cameras have a very specialized function. So we have a camera that shoots down each sideline. We have a camera that shoots down each goal line. Those cameras and those replays of those cameras are primarily only coming into the sequence of the show if there's a play on the sideline. Did he step out? Did he get 2 feet in? You know, did the ball cross the goal line before his knee was down? And there are a lot of cameras, I don't say a lot, but there's a few cameras like that that really have a very specific assignment. So when that pops up in the game, you know automatically that's the first place I'm going to look to see if they have the angle that's going to, you know, give a defining view to the viewer.
Yeah, I think that's the magic of digital recording technology. Which is another aspect that changed. I was trying to think about this, Fred. Probably changed in the early 90s when the Belgians came up with that silly thing called an EVS, which was forget about videotape, and we're going to record on servers, and we're going to put them in the TV mobile, and we're going to learn how to record six or seven items on the same machine, which in the old days you recorded one.
Correct.
And so that simple recording ability changed how many cameras you could have. And particularly what we describe, like I grew up in the ABC system, the Bruce camera, we used to call it a Bruce camera. That camera is strictly locked off in hockey. They're locked off right over top of the goals.
Right.
So, you know, whether the replay is going to happen, well, that camera, that record's going to have that replay. So you don't have to worry about certain things.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, that's correct.
Fred Godelli is with us, the executive producer of Sunday Night Football. Take a quick break and come back with more after these messages. It's Bob McCown. It's John Shannon on the program today. Fred Godelli, executive producer, Sunday Night Football, is with us. I should know the answer to this, Godelli, but I don't, because I'm a little dumb. Did you have your broadcasters in stadium last year?
The entire season. Yeah. We traveled, the announcers traveled. We were at every game.
You will experience, however, something a little bit different this year, because I suspect you're going to get full stadia, in many, may probably most, if not all, of the stadia.
Yeah. I mean, New York announced that the Giants and Jets can have a full stadium this year in New Jersey. LA looks like the Rams and the Chargers will have a full stadium this year. Obviously, Florida, they would add a full stadium last year if they could have. Texas, I mean, I think we're going to be having the fans back. Yes, thankfully.
We've talked a lot about it, and I know you're in a truck, but how eerie was it watching football games with nobody there?
It was, I mean, you know, once the game was going, you know, you were more into the, you know, the the flow of the game. But, you know, being in certain places where, like the Superdome, you know, when the Packers went in there on that Sunday night, you know, Aaron Rodgers was able to do things with his cadence that there isn't any way he would have been able to do if we would have been in a, you know, a normal Superdome environment. And I don't know that anybody used it more to his advantage than Aaron Rodgers did throughout the season, because not only was he affecting people, you know, with his voice, but he was hearing things coming off the other sideline or from the defense that he never would have heard in his entire career. And he used it, he told me, to his advantage. So, yeah, I mean, you know, and I would say even for us, you know, we kind of NFL films did a great job providing us with a as authentic a soundtrack as they could for our game. But we tried to lean in hard to try to hear the sounds coming off the field, because we thought that people might be hearing some things that, you know, they had not heard before. And in some games, it really paid off for us last year. We ended up going on a delay. And at the end of every game, I would get an email from the person working the delay. And, you know, he would have eliminated about 150 to 200 curses every game.
Explain when you talk about what you were getting from NFL films. Not many people would understand that.
So they went a few years ago and recorded the natural sound in every NFL stadium. You know, obviously SoFi wasn't up yet, and had like 3 or 4 hours of just natural sound from a game.
Wow.
And they were able to go in they built like a software system where, hey, here's what it sounds like, you know, when the 49ers score a touchdown. Hey, here's what it sounds like when the 49ers make an interception. Hey, here's what it sounds like when the opponent scores a touchdown on the 49ers. And they built this little software system. They made it very, very user intuitive and very simple. So at every game that we did and all the other, you know, NFL broadcasters did, the artificial sound was actually sound from that stadium.
That's extraordinary. I was going to ask, so we at home hear this fake noise.
Yeah.
You have that where you are. Did your broadcasters have it in their headsets?
Yeah, we would sneak a little bit into their ears just because, you know, it was so quiet that, you know, you could, you know, really kind of lose energy, you know, pretty quickly and start having a conversation you would have sitting in a living room versus announcing a football game.
Right.
So we would sneak it in there a little bit, not full.
You've worked with some extraordinary talent over the course of your career. And I talent is an interesting thing. I don't have to tell you. They can be egomaniacal, problematic, argumentative, humble, everything you could possibly imagine.
Insecure.
Insecure. And a lot of these things all at the same time, which makes the job of dealing with these people, myself excluded, of course, problematic from time to time. Tell us a story of that maybe you've never told of a situation with an announcer, whether good, bad, or indifferent, just to give us some kind of sense of what you might have to go through on a day-to-day basis.
Oh, God. Let's see. Who do I want to nail here?
Well, we can do it without names.
Yeah.
I'm not looking for you to spread dirt here.
You know, I'll be honest with you. Dennis Miller was interesting because, you know, Dennis Miller was a very sophisticated sports fan.
Real smart guy, too.
Really smart. And had worked in live television, obviously, because he worked on Saturday Night Live, but had never been on the air for 3 hours.
Right.
You know, so we'd come on the air, everybody's wearing a jacket and a tie. And like, you know, by the, you know, end of the third quarter, like, he'd be stripped down to t-shirt, underwear, and he just wanted his clothes off. And I'd be like, hey, Dennis, you know, I can't come back and put you on camera any longer, or Al or Dan, you know, if you're going to be naked by the time we hit the fourth quarter, you know, so, you know, that was interesting. And then, you know, working with Dick Vitale, you know, which I did in the early 90s, who I absolutely love, you know, taking direction, like, wasn't one of his great, one of his great traits. Like, he would just want to yell and scream, and there'd be like a winning basket, you know, Steve Alford would hit one at the buzzer and they beat Michigan, and Assembly Hall would be going crazy, and Dick would be yelling and screaming and be like, hey, can you just like lay out here for like 10 seconds and let the crowd take over? But he and I were great friends. I mean, one time he calls me, you know, as you know, Dick has one eye. So he calls me at 3 o'clock in the morning. Hey, Freddie, I can't find my contact. I can't see. You got to come down here. And I'm like, it's 3 o'clock in the morning, man. And he's like, I know, but I can't see. So put on a pair of shorts, a t-shirt, go down to his room, open the door at 3 a.m. He's in boxers. I'm like, that is a great sight. Walk into his bathroom, and there's the contact stuck on the mirror. Take the contact off the mirror, give it to him. Yeah, I mean, you know, you're always, the one thing I've always tried to make sure I, you know, never lost sight of, that people at home don't know what's screwing up in the truck. They have no idea. But people are really judging this on how good the announcers are. And if you, you know, so, I mean, they're under that kind of pressure all the time. And so I get the idiosyncrasies. I get those sudden outbursts. I mean, Madden, you know, would hit the talk back, and, you know, he'd say, hey, you're missing a great fucking game tonight. You know? And I knew what that meant. But, you know, I got it. They were truly the face of the broadcast. And if you weren't doing your job, you know, there was going to be some frustration, or if they weren't put in the light they wanted to be put in, there would be frustration. But I didn't, that part of it has never really been a big deal for me. I feel like I've always had a great relationship with almost every talent I've worked with.
How important was it? You talked about making sure that the viewer didn't know that there was pure panic in the truck. How important was it for you to make sure that the announcers didn't know there was pure panic in the truck?
Yeah, my tone doesn't change when I talk to the announcers. It's the same from beginning to end, no matter what's going on in the truck. When I have to talk to them, they're not going to know what's going on in the truck. You know what I mean? Right. You know, this is the same guy I've been talking, you know, I hope Al would say this is the same guy I've been talking to for 21 years. So yeah, it's important that they not know, you know, the ship is sinking.
Yeah, and you mentioned Al's name. You know, your network went and hired Mike Tirico. Right. So now you've built a succession plan. Mm-hmm. Both people, we met them both, great guys. How do you manage the egos, the personalities of a guy saying, here's the legend. Oh, and by the way, here's the guy who's going to take his job one day. How do you manage that?
You know, I think you just kind of let it run its own course. You know, I mean, you can use all the sports analogies you want, right? I mean, Bill Walsh had Montana and Steve Young at the same time, right? Montana knew why Steve Young was there. You know, Steve Young knew why Steve Young was there, you know? And so I think it kind of runs its course, and there comes a time where a decision gets made. I don't know that we're near that at this point, but that's how you manage it. There's not much to say or do about it.
Your play-by-play guys generally have long, I mean, I know there haven't been a whole lot of them, but they have had long careers. They are professionals. Mm-hmm. They are in that job because they are among the best at what they do. Color guys almost invariably are former players who, when you first get them, are pretty green. I assume then that you spend more time with your color commentators than you do with your play-by-play guys because of that learning process. True?
That's 100% true. And don't forget, the play-by-play guy is a professional broadcaster, right? Mm-hmm.
That's the point, yeah.
Yeah, he knows what he's, or she knows what they're doing. They know the rules, you know, they know where they can go and not go. And like, so, you know, we just hired Drew Brees. So we've been spending a lot of time with Drew in this off season, really trying to teach him, you know, from the beginning, you know, what it takes to be a really good color commentator and to be a broadcaster. And, you know, I think whenever somebody gets in that job, it's a little overwhelming at first because there are so many things to know. And I don't think they ever really consider all the things they may have to speak about in the course of a game, right? We all get into sports because we want to cover the game. Okay, we're going to cover the game, but there seems to be controversy every single week. Some of it very serious, some of it legal, you know, and, you know, you're going to have to speak about it. You're going to have an opinion about it. And, you know, I don't think any of them ever thought about that, you know, as they said, yeah, I want to be a football broadcaster. Right. Now, hey, you know, and not only that, never, in my opinion, I'd be interested in what you think, Bob, words matter more now than ever. Any off-the-cuff comment could get you fired, canceled forever, you know? So words really matter. And trying to make people understand that, they hear you, but I don't think they really understand it.
Breeze's role, where do you see his role in this show?
Well, he's going to be doing Notre Dame football with Mike Tirico, so he'll be calling games. Mm-hmm. Saturdays, and then on Sunday he'll be in the studio with Mike on Football Night in America. So he'll be a studio. So he's got to learn. And those are two different, you know, those are two different disciplines: calling a game and being a studio analyst. So he's got to learn two things at the same time.
What's a Purdue guy doing calling Notre Dame football?
Well, he's got a Purdue game this year, so he's all excited about that.
It's intriguing. I'm presuming here. Is there a tendency to go after the big name former player rather than go after the guy who you perceive can be a high quality broadcaster?
Well, you know, Drew is somebody that I've been meeting with in production meetings since, I want to say, 2002 or 2003. And then obviously you see him in a press conference every single week. You see him interviewed quite a bit. He's explaining things to you in a production meeting so you can put them on air. So you get a pretty good sense like, yeah, I think this guy has the potential to be very good. Now, I've also, you know, have spoken to players who, you know, who don't play quarterback or not your Hall of Famer that are good too. But some of it is, hey, what's the right role for this person? You know, there are certain positions that don't really lend themselves to seeing the game globally, right? Sure. I mean, I don't think like defensive linemen are going to see the game the same way a quarterback does. And not only see the game that way, but the dynamic of the locker room and the team and, you know, how all that gets managed and, you know, who's the guy out front when shit hits the fan. I mean, that's kind of what the quarterback has to do. So he's got a lot of different job responsibilities. So a lot of times, I'm also looking at, hey, what position did this guy play? Because he might be a little bit limited on talking about other aspects of the game. I'm not saying that's 100%, but I think it's, you know, true more often than not.
I don't know if this is a fair question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. How did Tony Romo change everybody's attitudes about the position, or did it?
You know, I think, you know, what Tony did, was he kind of broke the natural rhythm of a telecast or the byplay between a play-by-play announcer and an analyst, because he was coming in places that traditionally that person didn't come in. So like, you know, the teams are at the line of scrimmage, they're calling out signals. That was normally the domain of the play-by-play announcer, but Tony astutely saw that he could really give people some keen insight based on how the defense was changing, what the signals were, and all those different things. And to Jim Nance's credit, Jim made the room. I think Jim probably saw it right away, and he made the room for Tony. So, you know, Tony, you know, it's funny. I talked to Tony when he was retiring and going into broadcasting, and he said to me before he ever did a game, look, I know every signal and I know every alignment, you know, that a defense can have. I know everybody's offensive signals. And when I see them, I'm going to tell people what they are. And I said, well, if you do that, you'll be the most unique announcer on television. And he set out and he did it. you know, and that's how he changed it. But just like Madden changed the game, not everybody's going to be able to do that. There was, you know, there might have been 20 next Maddens, and none of them ever rose to anywhere close to the level of John Madden. And I think if you're going to try to do what Tony did or what Tony does, you know, unless you've got a different way of presenting it, you know, you may come off as, you know, a Romo ripoff.
So what would your advice be to Chris Collinsworth then, who would be, you know, on your show after hearing all day and all week how great Tony was? What would your advice to Collinsworth be to say, stay in your lane?
Well, I'm not telling him to stay in his lane. I'm just saying, hey, look, you know, you've been considered one of the very, very best, if not the best, for a long, long time.
Yes, sir.
I don't think there is an urgency to dramatically change what you do. I mean, look, you know, I was always encouraging Chris to first guess, you know, in a big moment, because he studies a lot and he knows what's coming and he talks to a lot of people. And I say, look, if you've got a feel for what's coming, say it, you know, say it on TV. I mean, and he's done it. I mean, in that giant Patriot Super Bowl, the second one that we did, you know, when there was about a minute and 45 seconds left in the game, he said, hey, we're getting very, very close to the point where the Patriots may have to let the Giants score, you know, and like three plays later, Belichick let him score. So he's kind of, you know, he's got that kind of feel as well, but he's working with Al and they've got their own little rhythm. And, you know, I said, right. Look, you know, you don't have to be doing this, you know, to be like Tony Romo. Just kind of keep doing what you've been doing and try to get better at it.
Nobody prepares more than Collinsworth either. That's the magic.
No one.
Freddie, you have always been gracious with your time. We are out of time for this episode, but you know, we love chatting with you. It's great to see you. We hope you stay healthy and happy and keep doing what you're doing. And somewhere down the road, if we're still hanging around, we'll bug you again.
Can't wait to be bugged, man. It's always a pleasure talking to you, Bob and John, always.
Fred Godelli, the executive producer of Sunday Night Football. We'll come back after these messages. It's McCown, it's Shannon to wrap it up. And again, we can't say thank you enough to Fred Godelli for suffering with us. He's been doing it for, we usually only bug him once, maybe twice a year. He almost never says no. And I don't think we've ever had a conversation with him that was anywhere close to boring.
No. Well, you listen, you know, every producer wants to be an announcer anyway, so.
Well, and as Godelli said, that's what he wanted to be when he was at college.
I couldn't help smile late in the conversation when he said, we want Drew Brees to first guess. Because in the TV tree, you know, he talked about Arledge to Ebersol to Godelli. My first interaction with Dick Ebersol was at the 2002 Salt Lake Olympics when I worked for NBC. And this was the first time I ever heard the word and the phrase first guess, which is to say, go out on a limb, say that something's going to happen. If it does happen, you look like a genius. If it doesn't happen, explain why it didn't happen, and you look like a genius again. And that has been, it started really with Johnny Miller in golf on NBC. And then it's something that Dick has carried through with all of his productions until he retired, and guys like Fred have carried it on the family tree of television. So when he talked about teaching Drew Brees how to first guess, to me that was as good as it gets when it comes to little secrets within the television world.
So as somebody who got his start in the business as a I mean right away, but director, you know, producer, a guy in the truck,
yeah,
when you watch Godelli's work, What do you see that makes him good at what he does? And I can't analyze that, but you're not the executive producer of Sunday Night Football and Monday Night Football before that for 31, 32 years without being really good at what you do. No. What is that makes him good?
He puts the show on such a pedestal. And what I mean by that is there is no stone unturned. His level, you can see it. Every stoppage, the level of preparation. You know, we're in live sports, Bob. We love live sports because you only do it once, and you get to read and react situations. There's no always sit in the edit and fix it. There's no take two. Well, he's so prepared that it almost looks like he's rehearsed it all. And so his level of preparation is as deep as that football coach on either side or the starting quarterback of either side. And he, you know, he has access to that amount of information. Plus he has more bells and whistles, more toys than any other television show in sports in North America. And he's able to use them. And you can see that level of expertise every Sunday night. It truly is a phenomenal experience. And if you, it's like being an air traffic controller for him. You know, there's air traffic controllers are magic people. You know, they can, when you can land a plane with 300 people on an airport and there's 17 other planes in the air. Well, that's what Fred does every Sunday night on NBC. It's an amazing process. And it's a, I'll tell you what, it is a natural high to be able to do it, Bob.
Yeah. Well, we mentioned that, I think, during the broadcast, the number one show on television for 10 consecutive years. No other show has ever done that. No Seinfelds, no, any other show.
No.
No I Love Lucy.
And give the network credit. They have put it on a pedestal and left it on a pedestal, and they have not compromised that pedestal.
Yeah, you're 100% right. Again, our thanks sincerely to Fred Godelli. For John Shannon, Bob McCowan, we'll see you tomorrow if the creek don't rise. Thanks for watching. Thanks for listening. See you next time.